This is Intercom Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Hello and welcome again to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast for our 18th episode. For today's episode, we look at an article from the JCENM from earlier this year that helps us better understand trends in the U.S. and DKA admissions, in particular, possible drivers for those admissions and associated disparities. This study uses observational data from large databases, so we get to think about the methodology closely and the challenges that come with doing these types of investigations. As a reminder, in addition to hosting Endocrine Feedback Loop, I work as a general endocrinologist at Vanderbilt University, where I direct our outpatient clinic and serve as an associate director for our fellowship program. I'm delighted today to team up with two endocrinologists who both have expertise in understanding disparities in care and outcomes related to diabetes. Joining us today for the first time as our regular contributor is Joshua Joseph from The Ohio State University. Joshua focuses his clinical care on diabetes and cardiovascular disease with extensive research into diabetes and obesity in diverse population groups. He holds numerous leadership roles, both institutionally and nationally, including with the Endocrine Society. Our guest expert today is Kasia Lipska from Yale University. Kasia has extensive clinical and research expertise, also in diabetes, with one of her research areas of interest being drivers of admissions to the hospital for individuals with diabetes. She works to develop accessible data and quality metrics related to the care we as endocrinologists provide and is a highly sought after speaker for that reason. So we have the perfect pair of endocrinologists today to unpack this article. I'll add as a personal note that Joshua and I did our residency training together at Yale and so are excited to work with Kasia on this episode. As always, everything we say is our opinions only and not those of our respective institutions or the Endocrine Society. Today, we will review national trends in pediatric admissions for diabetic ketoacidosis 2006 to 2016, which was published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism in August 2021. Estelle Everett at the University of California, Los Angeles served as the first author for this paper. We'll now turn things over to Joshua, who will outline some of the key points the authors make in their introduction, as well as join Kasia in helping us understand key points about DKA admissions overall. Joshua?
Thank you so much, Chase, for that introduction and the introduction to the article. And in the introduction, there are a few key points that we'd like to recognize and discuss. The first is that DKA can have significant morbidity and mortality, though we know that mortality has decreased over the past century. Kasia, do you want to talk a little bit about why there have been such dramatic improvements in DKA morbidity and mortality?
Sure thing. And it's great to be here, Chase and Joshua. I'm excited to talk about this article. Well, it's 2021 and insulin was discovered exactly a century ago. So let's remind ourselves that DKA was almost invariably fatal until the discovery of insulin in 1921. Mortality was then dramatically reduced to less than 50% with the use of insulin, but still really high. And only really came down later with incorporation of antibiotics and forced hydration during DKA. Because let's not forget that DKA is often precipitated by something else. It's an infection, myocardial infarction, or some other stress that often precipitates DKA. So mortality associated with DKA is also tied to that precipitant. There were then like really major advances later on in the treatment of DKA. And what happened, and what you're all familiar with now, is that we have these very rigid protocols to follow when we treat patients with DKA with respect to how much insulin we give, at what rate, how we bolus, what we measure, how much fluid we give. And all of that has contributed to much better outcomes for patients with respect to surviving that DKA. So currently, mortality is less than 2% for these events, a huge advancement.
That is absolutely great information for our audience. And the advances over time, as you mentioned, have really been one of the greatest achievements in diabetes care as we think about diabetes management. So despite these advances in insulin formulations kind of that you mentioned, hospitalization rates for DKA are increasing. And the authors, I thought, did a nice job in the introduction of going through that. Other work indicates that younger individuals have higher rates of admission for DKA, potentially accounting for this increase in hospitalizations. But we know that there is limited comprehensive data on national estimates of pediatric DKA admissions, and that data is mostly single source data. It really doesn't come from broad databases with multiple sources. And so in this study, they had three objectives. The first objective was to describe the patient and hospital characteristics prevalent in pediatric DKA admissions nationally. The second is to describe the rates and trends of DKA admissions relative to all pediatric admissions. And third was to identify subgroups of pediatric patients more likely to be admitted with DKA and evaluate whether this risk changes over time. And so I would like to pass it back to Chase to talk a little bit about some of the methodology that was used in this study.
Thanks, Joshua. That's a helpful start here for outlining everything that the authors want to make sure that they are covering today. So we're going to do our usual real slow walk through the methodology here to make sure that we understand this. And in particular, the authors here use a study design that we haven't particularly looked at in one of our episodes before. So we're going to think about that. And that is that they use what is described as serial cross-sectional studies. Now, we've looked at cross-sectional studies before. And as a reminder of what those are, cross-sectional studies collect data on whatever population is being looked at a single point in time. So there is not a time component in a standard cross-sectional study. This contrasts with cohort studies in which there is a time component. In cohort studies, subjects are split into at least two groups. You have an exposed group and an unexposed group, and sometimes you have multiple depending upon the type of exposure that you're looking at. And then that group of subjects is followed over time to see if one group versus another develops an outcome or outcomes of interest more frequently than the other one does. Cross-sectional studies in and of themselves don't do that. So they collect all of their data at once, both the exposure and the outcome data. And so it can be a little bit challenging to identify clearly that cause and effect relationship because you don't have that time component there. What the authors do here is they do repeated cross-sectional studies. And this can be easy to confuse with a cohort study because you see data over time. And I think often because of our familiarity with cohort studies being the observational study that has a time component, we often assume that this is a cohort study. But this is different. This is, instead of a single cross-sectional study, they do multiple cross-sectional studies over time. And in a second here, we'll walk through when that data comes from. And that can give you a time component. Now, one thing that's still a key distinction between serial cross-sectional studies and cohort studies is it's not the same subjects that are being followed. In a cohort study, it is the same group of people. You'll lose a few patients over time from attrition, but largely it's the same group of subjects that you're following over time. With serial cross-sectional studies, they are brand new studies each time doing a cross-section of the population. You may happen to get a few of the same individuals when you repeat that cross-sectional study, but it's not designed to follow the same groups of people. So you still have a little bit of the challenge of trying to figure out the relationship between cause and effect, but it's particularly well suited to see trends over time. And so we're going to think about that. And as Joshua walked us through already, that's what the authors want to point out here. They're trying to look at some of the associations, but really they want to understand how these associations and these admissions have changed over time. So that's what we're going to be looking at here and thinking about. Okay, so now that we have that in our mind, it's how to think about this study, we'll look at this investigation in particular. And so where the data comes from, we want to hear a little bit more about that, but this is from the Healthcare Cost and Utilization Project Kids Inpatient Database, or KID, K-I-D is how that's abbreviated. So Akasha, can you outline for us, just give us a really high level overview of what this database is, because we're going to think about a few different databases that are used here. So can you give us a little bit of insight into what this is, how this database works?
Absolutely. In the U.S., we don't have a national healthcare system, so we have to piece together these different databases to answer different questions. And as you pointed out, this database is basically a series of these cross-sectional looks at patients. It's administrative data. So what does that mean? That means it's data that's collected during routine care. It's created by hospitals for billing. It includes all of the information that is typically used for billing, including discharge diagnoses, cost of that particular visit, the length of stay, discharge dates, and so on. It is one of the largest publicly available all-payer pediatric inpatient databases. And it's kid is just one part of that bigger HCAHPS group, which includes all of these hospital data from these cross sections over time. One key point, though, here is that these data are at the level of the admission, meaning that, and as we'll talk about this, each time we're looking at a bunch of different admissions among these patients, but we can't tell whether that admission is unique to the patient or it's a readmission because it's at the level of the admission. So we can know a lot of details about those admissions, but we can't link them individually as this person was admitted three times or this person was readmitted five times. It's admission level data. So that's something to keep in mind with this database. But it's a great resource. And for this particular question, I think it was a good choice.
So now let's think about how the authors use this data. So first of all, their main criteria that they use is they want to identify admissions with DKA, and this is in a pediatric patient population, and they base this on ICD codes. So just like Asha mentioned, so this is administrative database, so they use these ICD either 9 codes for the earlier years or 10 for the later years. And in particular, they looked at 4 years where this cross-sectional data was collected. So the earliest one was 2006 and another one 2009. That was repeated 2012, and then the last set that they have is from 2016. And as they collected data from this, a few different things that they collected. So one key difference that they noted is that they wanted to see whether this was labeled as being type 1 diabetes or type 2 diabetes. They were not interested in looking at the newborn population or pregnancy-related admissions because those are often very different questions that you're trying to answer if you're looking at those groups. So they intentionally excluded anybody with an admission associated with that. There was numerous patient-level variables that were assessed. So we're going to look at these in more detail, but just to quickly go through them. So age was looked at in this patient population, the pediatric patient population. Sex was collected, race and ethnicity, the payer, income, and urbanicity. So we're going to look through these. Joshua here in a second is going to walk us through the results. And so we're going to think about this patient-level data. But a couple of things I wanted us to think about in a little bit more detail before we move on from this section is the income. So the way that the authors collected income data was looking at the zip code from where the patient resided and then looking at the median household income in that zip code. So I wanted Kasia to give us a little bit of insight here. We know from numerous data that socioeconomic status is one of, if not actually the biggest driver of health outcomes. And yet it's one of the most difficult pieces of information to get in these observational studies. And so authors, investigators are often presented with this challenge of how do you get it? It's the most important thing that we need to look at. And it's also one of the most difficult things to get. So can you, Kasia, give us an overview of how you can go about trying to determine income in these studies and then the associated limitations that go along with the challenges of getting this data?
Right. And you're exactly right in that this is a difficult variable to collect. Income is sensitive. So it's often not collected routinely by hospitals or shared with others for those reasons. So because of that, area-based socioeconomic indicators obtained from address data linked to geocoded census information is often used as an alternative because we don't have that patient level data. There are some databases where we have that. For example, MEPS or Medical Expenditure Panel Survey has specifically patient-level household income data. But most routinely collected administrative data do not. And so that's one way to kind of get at this is to get census data is in the public domain. So we can have that available to us at that area level. And then we can link that to each patient's zip code to estimate where the area level sort of indicator of their socioeconomic status. Obviously, this is just one factor when you assess socioeconomic status, right? There are lots of different other factors that are important, education levels, employment, housing, and so on. But income is a pretty big one. So I think it makes sense that they focused on this one. There are some nice reviews of what should one use for socioeconomic status to assess it in a study like this. And most experts agree that median household income is a really good one for that purpose.
And one final comment on this patient level data before we move on is that they wanted to decide whether they would classify a subject as living in an urban environment or not. And so they dichotomized that. So if you lived in a city with more than 50,000 residents, you were considered to live in an urban setting. And then if it was less than 50,000, then it would be a non-urban setting. The authors also collected hospital data. And so there are fewer things there, but still some important ones. So the geographic region, part of the country where this hospital is, whether it's a government or a private hospital, and then the size of the hospital overall. And again, when Joshua walks us through the results, we'll think about that information. A couple of other comments about data that was collected related to the hospital stay itself. So length of stay was noted. The authors also followed the total charges associated with those hospitalizations. And I thought it would be helpful for Kasia and Joshua as well to comment on the challenges here. As we know from lots of data and from our own work as physicians, that total charges are often extremely disconnected from lots of other realities financially, whether that's what the patient pays or what the insurance pays or what the hospital actually spends itself. But it does tend to be the most readily available data that we can see here. So any comments from either of you two on how helpful it is to know these total charges, or are they so disconnected from any other way that money is spent that it has limited value?
I think it depends on the purpose. We could have a whole podcast series on total charges, such a complex area in terms of figuring out how much something costs and to whom, right? I think it's a helpful estimate of how much is being charged, but it's not necessarily how much a hospital had to pay for those services. And it often has nothing to do with what the patient had to pay. So, and that really matters to patients, right? How much they're responsible for paying for those hospitalizations out of pocket. We don't have information on that in this particular paper. So we only have sort of the charge or the bill that's made by the hospital, but it's not necessarily how much they were paid for those services.
Yeah, 100% agree with Kasia there. And I think you can almost think of it as the healthcare system cost versus the individual patient cost. And we know in diabetes, particularly when we think about management of diabetes, those individual patient costs are tremendous. It's probably the leading disorder as far as patient costs when we think through all the different medications as well as all the lifestyle therapies that someone has to manage with diabetes. The other challenge, I think, with some of the total charge data is whether it includes professional fees or whether it doesn't, and what happens to some of those non-covered charges. Are they included? Some hospitals do, some hospitals don't. So there are some challenges there as well. And I think the one thing that we don't think about a lot in research in this area is what are the opportunity costs to the patient. Here in this instance, we have patients who are in school and they are missing days of school when they are admitted for DKA. And what is the opportunity cost in the immediate sense for them? And then in the long-term sense from that are also costs that are bare.
Good. Thanks to you both. That's helpful. And we'll come back to this as we think about this, but there's always a couple different ways when we look at these studies. One is we want to recognize the limitations that are intrinsic to these databases. These usually have nothing to do with the authors themselves because the database is often organized by somebody else. So that's not something that we would critique them for. I think what we always want to look at is to see if the authors are recognizing these limitations. And we'll talk about this as we go through the discussion, how the authors do that. But that's always an important thing is that those are recognized and dealt with as best they can, though having to understand this is the data that they've got, so this is what they have to work with. Okay, so that's the first database that we're thinking about, that KIDS inpatient database, the KID. So the other step that the authors do is that they use another database as a comparison point. So they use the National Health Interview Survey from these same corresponding years, and that's to try to determine the population totals for those with diabetes so that they can then calculate rate of DKA admissions per population with diabetes. So Kasia, again, we'll call on you here. A couple of questions related to that. So why is this step necessary in the first place? Why do they need a second database to look at that? And then follow-up question to that is, if you're going to do that, then what challenges do you get with comparing data from two different databases?
We can see why they did that, right? So if our data just contains admissions for DKA, all we can do is count those admissions and say, here's how they change. So we can look at the sort of the raw numbers. And that's important just to understand the total burden of these DKA admissions. We can also look at how they compare with respect to other admissions, because we have that right in the database. We have all hospital admissions. We can pick out the DK admissions and look at DK admissions relative to all other admissions. But that's not as satisfying, right? As understanding, like, has the rate of DKA increased among people with diabetes, which is a really important question here. And that we don't have because we don't have the total population. We only see in the HCUP database who is admitted, not those who are not admitted. So this is why they bring in this additional database to really look at that denominator of how many people with diabetes do we have? Are these rates increasing because we see an increase in the rate of diabetes? Or is there something else going on that is driving these DKA admissions? And of course, when you bring another database, you're piecing different information together that's collected in a different way. So there is going to be a limitation. Both data are nationally representative and weighted, which is good. And you have data from the same years, which is also good. So you're comparing them. But it's imperfect, right? There's going to be differences in how the data were collected in these. And you're really like providing a kind of a broad estimate for the rate of diagnosed diabetes. And just an important point that in the National Health Interview Survey, the question is about, you know, do you have a diagnosis of diabetes? So it's self-reported. Just an important note.
Good. So that's a nice segue into just a few high-level comments on the statistics that are done here. So the authors do exactly what Kasia suggests, that the reason that you use multiple databases is so that you can provide weight. So you look at that kids and patient database, and then that allows you to generate nationally representative estimates. So again, there's going to be uncertainty there for a lot of reasons. If for no other reasons, just like Kasia had mentioned, one of these databases is pulling diabetes data based on ICD codes that are dropped. Another one is patient self-reported data. So there is going to be some differences there. And then when you start expanding that and coming up with national estimates, that necessarily introduces uncertainty there. But again, I think this is a necessary step, and we just have to recognize that there are intrinsic limitations there. Nothing that the authors did wrong, but just have to be aware that there's always uncertainty when you start generalizing in that way. So what the authors then say that they'll do is that they can report both the frequency of DKA admission and DKA admissions per 10,000 pediatric admissions, and that's by patient and hospital level characteristics. And in a second, Joshua's going to walk us through that. And finally, in the methodology here, the authors generate adjusted odds ratios by accounting for these patient and hospital level characteristics. And so there's a host, we touched on some of them already. We're going to look at them in more details. And before we turn it over to Joshua, any other comments from either of you two, Joshua or Kasia, on any other adjustments that you would have liked to seen besides these patient and hospital level characteristics that we talked about already?
From my standpoint, you know, I think that they did a relatively good job in picking factors to adjust for. You know, I think we're always trying to conceptualize how well can someone care for their diabetes and how much access do they have to do that. And they've picked factors that we know are related to that. We never can pick those exact factors in a study. But I would say, based on the work that I've seen, they did a pretty good job of that. Kasia?
I totally agree. And in some ways, adjustment has a role here, but it depends on where you're looking from, right? From sort of a national perspective, just I think sometimes descriptive statistics can be the key to any paper, right? If we want to really see what's going on with DKA admissions in this country among kids, just having those raw rates is also really important. And sometimes we do a lot of adjustment to figure things out and make them fancy. but the simple descriptives, how often is this happening and has this increased over time? Those I think are key. That being said, I agree with you. They did a really nice job picking what out of the factors they were able to access for adjustment. I think they did a great job.
Good. So based on that, then let's move right into the results, because that sets us up nicely then to think about the results that the authors found here. So Joshua, why don't you walk us through that? There's a lot of numbers, a lot of data here. So we'll try to keep it relatively high level so that everyone can follow along with us. But then with the important ones along the way, we'll slow down and discuss this as we go along. So Joshua, why don't you walk us through the authors' results?
Perfect. So what they looked at here, as has been mentioned, was the DKA admissions. And there were close to 150,000 DKA admissions that were evaluated in the study. when we think about, you know, and Chase walked very nicely through these cross-sectional series of analyses earlier. And so when we think about the individuals included, it was about 95% type 1 diabetes and 5% type 2 diabetes. When we look at the age range, it really ranged from individuals who had an age of 0 to 2 years, representing about 3% of the cohort, all the way up to individuals who were 18 to 20 years, representing around 37% of the cohort of individuals with DKA admissions. And then there was only about 0.4% that were unknown. So the unknown rate was pretty low in this study, which I thought was a strength. As far as the sex, the 54% of individuals were female and 46% were male. So about half and half in the study. And then when we look at race ethnicity, what we see is about 50% were white, 19% Black, 12% Hispanic or Latinx, and then 1% Asian Pacific Islander, 1% Native American. Other was 3%, and that's when people pick like two races or other races that are ethnicities that are not included. And then unknown for race, differential to what we saw for age was about 15%. And this is about what we see in some of the national databases and is an area that I think we are all trying to improve so that when we disaggregate data, we have better data. They also looked at the size of the hospital system. They broke it up into kind of small, medium, and large. So the small percentage was about 13%, medium 25%, and large 60%. And then lastly, thinking about, you know, whether the hospital was kind of urban or non-urban. Chase brought that up earlier in the comments. And it was about 81% urban hospitals and 19% non-urban hospitals. The next piece that they looked at was the unadjusted rate of DKA admissions per 10,000 pediatric admissions. And they did this over time. And what they showed was that it increased from 120.5 in 2006 to 128.6 in 2009 to 151.8 in 2012 to 217.7 in 2016. All of this was despite a decrease in the length of stay. So although there were more admissions per 10,000 pediatric admissions, the length of stay decreased. Next, they took a look at admissions rates per patient, as well as hospital characteristics, and the admissions per 10,000 admissions increased by age, but not when we looked at the per 10,000 youth with diabetes. So when they just look at all admissions, those rates were increasing. But when they looked at particularly individuals with or youth with diabetes, those rates were not increasing.
Kasha, maybe you can help us out here, because this one, when I was reading through this, I really got stuck on this. And Joshua and I discussed this for a little while before, because as we know, as there's an increasing prevalence of type 1 diabetes as you go up in age groups, just because there's more and more people to have developed type 1 diabetes. And so it was a little struggle for me for emphasizing this increase in age. And when you look at this in your mind and when you look at this data, does this represent anything more than just an increasing frequency of individuals with type 1 diabetes and so an increased chance for people to get DKA because there are more people who have the possibility of getting DKA? Or is there anything else that's going on here with this steady increase up those age brackets that Joshua outlined for us?
Yeah, it's a great question. And this is where looking at it different ways gives you a slightly different answers or a different estimate. If we just look at the raw number of DKA admissions, they did increase in that last year in particular. So just the raw number. But that doesn't tell us, okay, per people with diabetes, or maybe there are more potentially kids at risk for DKA over that time. When you look at that second, the rate per admissions, that's a tricky one to interpret because it really depends on whether admissions for other causes are increasing or decreasing, right? And in that particular way of looking at it, it does look like DKA admissions increased, as Joshua just said, 217 or something like that. But that's looking relative to other admissions. So you can have an increase because you have more DKA admissions, or you could have an increase because you have fewer other admissions. And then, as you pointed out, the last way of looking at it using that other piece of data from National Health Interview Survey is to look at per population of people with diabetes. And there, you see a slight increase in that last year. It's not as pronounced as they make it out to be. And they really focus on this middle piece, which is relative to other admissions. And as you perfectly pointed out, if diabetes is increasing in prevalence among older groups and also over time, that will drive DK admissions higher. So I agree that that is one explanation for some of these trends we're seeing.
So we'll come back to that in the discussion because the authors comment on that there. So we'll circle back. Obviously, this is particularly important because that highest number that they saw is with that 18 to 20 year old, which is where, at least with me and all the rest of us who are adult endocrinologists, that's really where we start seeing these individuals. And so I think it's important for us to really start wrapping our head around that data and also putting that in context of other data that's out there. So we'll definitely come back to that after Joshua finishes walking us through the rest of the results.
And just one other comment on that, back to something that Kasia said earlier, unique admissions versus readmissions. We know that that 16 to 24 age range is when individuals are starting to manage type 1 diabetes more on their own. We know that that's a transition period. Many people are going to college. And so I would also be interested, you know, they don't have this data, but is some of that driven by readmissions as well in that age range, particularly because that's when A1C also starts to rise. The next piece we wanted to walk through was really race and ethnicity. And what we saw for race ethnicity is that the highest admission rates per 10,000 were in the Black American group at 188 per 10,000 compared to 170 in the white group, 103 in the Hispanic group, 67 in the Asian group, 134 in the Native American group, and 108 in the other group. So you can see from that that the Black American group was really higher than all the other groups that we see. The second piece of that was when we looked at the rate per 10,000 youth with diabetes, the Black American group had the highest rate there as well. I won't walk through all the numbers, but suffice it to say, those really lined up particularly well, irrespective of whether you looked at per 10,000 admissions or per 10,000 youth with diabetes. The other areas, I won't walk through all the numbers, but I would just like to mention a couple of areas. One was that non-urban individuals had higher rates of DKA per 10,000 admissions compared to urban individuals. As we would expect, and the reason why they wanted to adjust for this, household income was another important factor, with those individuals with the highest income having the lowest rates of DKA admissions, both overall, as well as when we looked at the rate per 10,000 youth with diabetes. And then lastly, just emphasizing those year-to-year trends again that we talked about, that we did see these increases over time in year-to-year trends. The next piece of the paper goes through the odds ratios. So these are the adjusted odds ratios for DKA admissions. And this is where we get to think about those factors that we're adjusting for that we kind of talked through earlier, those individual as well as kind of hospital level variables. And what they showed here was in comparison, when they did the DKA versus just other admissions, in comparison to the 3 to 5 year old group, the 0 to 2 year old group had less odds or lower odds of a DKA admission, but then the 6 to 8, 9 to 11, 12 to 14, 15 to 17, and 18 to 20 all had higher odds of DKA admissions, with the highest group being the 18 to 20 group compared to the 3 to 5 year olds. In the adjusted odd ratio for hospitalized versus not, what we saw there was that it was really tough. There wasn't as much data and the confidence intervals were very wide here. And so it was really hard to make conclusions about those changes based on the data that is provided. Next, there was the female versus male sex. And what we saw was that females had higher odds than males in the, you know, DKA versus other admissions. Black compared to white groups had higher odds of admissions, but notably other groups, including the Hispanic, Asian, Pacific Islander, Native American, and other groups, had lower odds of DKA versus other admissions. And so I think that was something really important to point out, that all minority groups might not be the same when we look at this data. And then when we look at self-pay versus private insurance, individuals who had self-pay had 33% higher odds of a DKA versus other admission. Public insurance, it was a 17% higher odds versus private insurance. And so both public self-pay and then other forms of insurance all had higher odds compared to private insurance. When we look at the urbanicity, we found that the non-urban group had higher odds of DKA admissions compared to the urban group. And then when we look at income, what they showed was that those with the lowest income versus the highest income had higher odds of those DKA admissions. They also did something that I thought was very nice, and they looked at the regions of the country. We all know that different regions may have different access to high-quality hospitals, et cetera. And what they found was that when they looked at the Midwest, South, or West compared to the Northeast, there were higher odds of DKA admissions in the Midwest, South, and West, which was really important. The last thing that I wanted to kind of make sure that we mentioned was to think through kind of the size of the hospitals. So they do this via bed number, and where Kasha is up there at Yale is one of the highest bed numbers in the United States, right? Top three big hospital center. Some of the hospitals here where I am in Ohio have very low bed numbers, particularly in some of our community and rural areas. And so what they found there was that when we look at small hospital size versus large hospital size, the smaller hospital size had higher odds of DKA admissions compared to the larger hospital size. And then the last piece is just the years. So when we look at 2016 versus 2006, there was a 63% higher odds of DKA admissions in 2016 compared to 2006. And that really kind of increased over time, but most prevalently in 2012 and in 2016.
Let's just look at the race ethnicity data in this paper. If you look at the adjusted odds relative to other admissions, it's exactly as you had said, slightly higher odds among Black versus white kids. But when you look then relative to hospitalized versus not, so adjusting for diabetes rates, the kids who were Black actually had lower odds of DKA admission. And so it's complicated because you have the rate of diabetes is going to be different by race and ethnicity, and it's also going to differ by type of diabetes. So you're going to have more type 2 diabetes among Native American kids versus white, perhaps more among Black versus white, so a little bit lower odds of DKA among that type of diabetes versus among white. It's really hard to interpret for me what's going on here. But I think that certainly in those higher age groups, there's also more type 2 diabetes, which is also sometimes associated with DKA. And that's going to vary by race and ethnicity. And lots of different factors that go into making those odds ratios, which I think is a little hard to unpack here.
Very important points. And even when we think through those racial ethnic groups, do they have higher rates of like ketosis prone type 2 diabetes?
Exactly. Right?
Where right. They may be coded as DKA, et cetera. Very important.
Thanks, Joshua and Prakasha, for your comments along the way there as well. So now we're going to segue into the author's discussion and conclusion. We're going to look at their main findings, those high-level interpretations, and then we'll think critically about those and add our comments along the way. So for the two main findings that the authors, the way that they summarize them, so their first one is that they state that DKA admissions increased from 2006 to 2016, and that was despite a decrease in total pediatric admissions. And then the second of their main findings that they state is that these increases among the subgroups that Joshua walked us through, it was disparate. They were not equally distributed among those groups. So the authors do note that there has been an increasing prevalence and incidence of type 1 diabetes. And they do agree that that likely contributed to some of these increases over time, but that that was likely not the primary driver. It was a small contribution, but would be unlikely to explain the extent of these increases in DK admissions that they report here. Then the authors go through and comment on several of these disparate results among these subgroups. And the first one that they point out is what we've touched on several times already, is that they state that the increase that we see in older pediatric patients may reflect that vulnerable transition period. And I would comment on that, first of all, and say that we certainly know that that's the case. Joshua already mentioned some of the issues that make that a vulnerable transition period. We've looked at that before. Earlier this year, we did an episode of looking at some of those drivers and also discussed how that is a vulnerable time. And I think we all see that clinically when we see these patients in our clinic, even as an adult endocrinologist, when they come in starting around age 18, how difficult it is. And I would just comment, I'd be interested in hearing Joshua and Kasha's any further thoughts that they have. I'm just not completely convinced that this data shows that. I think it's the biggest thing that I would quibble about is, again, is that when you look at that data, when you actually compare it to the frequency or the prevalence of diabetes in the population, we don't really see that increase. Yes, there are caveats to that. It's difficult to tease out the type of diabetes that's there. I just think that there is at least a plausible alternative explanation, is that there's just more type 1 diabetes as you go up. And so there are more people who might get a DKA admission because there is more type 1 diabetes. So again, we've touched on that already a little bit, but Joshua, Kasha, any final thoughts on that point that the authors make?
I agree exactly. And as Joshua, as you pointed out, not only is there more type 1 diabetes, but in that oldest group, there's also much more type 2 diabetes and ketosis prone type 2 diabetes. And again, we're looking at discharge diagnoses based on ICD codes. Some of them may be presumed to be type 1 because they came in with DKA and they're kids, but some of them may actually turn out to be type 2 patients in the long term if you follow them and see what happens, because they had this ketosis prone type 2 diabetes and that may be contributing. So I agree with your points.
Disagree with both of you. This is always the challenge with data, is when you're trying to do these analyses. And in epidemiology, we always think about, is it causal or is it not, right? We have Hill's causal postulates and all these different pieces, but this is the largest challenge, is trying to understand what is that primary driver that is driving these changes that we see over time. And I think, Chase, you nicely kind of went through what are some of those options there that may be driving what we see, but you can't detail that out, you know, necessarily in analyses like this.
So a few other issues that we'll highlight that the authors themselves point out. So they point out that the increase in females being admitted with DKA may reflect psychosocial challenges. And they point out to several other articles in the literature that highlight that. They also point out that when you do that comparison of Black individuals compared to the white race and ethnicity, that increase in admissions for DKA that they saw, that really does fit with the rest of the medical literature. So adds to that body of evidence, and it is suggestive that that fits along with that and supports that. Another thing that they point out is that the income and payer is highly predictive of admission risk for DKA. And I would point out here, I think that that's certainly true. I do think we always want to be careful with these things. And Joshua's already suggested that that cause and effect is difficult. And it's particularly difficult in cross-sectional studies because we don't have a time component of individual subjects to really identify that. So yes, I think it's most likely that if you want to think of it as the income and payer as being that exposure, that it's more likely to lead to that outcome of DKA admission. But just for the sake of argument, you could imagine a scenario to where it's actually, if you have an individual who is potentially getting admitted repeatedly for DKA, that then actually has an effect on that individual's or the family's income and insurance status. And so maybe it's actually the other way around. It's the DKA admission that then caused the income to be lower and the payer to be different than it might otherwise. So we don't know that that's the case, and that's one of the challenges with cross-sectional studies, but using that simply to highlight that there's a potential alternate explanation, or that the cause and effect is different than how we might naturally think of that. And one final thing, as was pointed out already, is that there were lower rates for DKA admission in the Northeast, And a couple of explanations for that. And I like the way that the authors think about this here, because they really do think about it as far as numerator and denominator. So they say, well, it could be that there are more specialized centers in the Northeast, and so they're able to keep their patients out of the hospital. And so that then lowers the numerator, and that's why the rates are better. But they also admit that, well, with these specialized centers, there could be lots of other admissions for other reasons, and patients are traveling to the Northeast for that reason. And so maybe the explanation for the lower rate is just that the denominator is higher, and either of those would lead to lower rates. So I think that they do a nice job of critically thinking through their own results and potential explanations there. The authors also point out a few limitations. So as has been suggested before with these databases, so they say that there is possibility for misclassification in the database, particularly when they switched from ICD-9 to ICD-10 codes, that that's going to be a frequent limitation with these studies. They point out, as we've looked at already, that they couldn't distinguish admissions from readmissions in this database, and that they also couldn't identify admissions for new onset versus existing diabetes. So Joshua and Kasia, before we move on, any other limitations that you would see that would be worth pointing out that the authors haven't already pointed out here?
One that we all have to think about is, you know, historically we thought about private insurance, and most private insurance comes from your employer, right, in the U.S., and we've thought of public insurance, and public insurance is kind of Medicare or Medicaid, et cetera. But, you know, I think more and more, at least when I see patients in the clinic and we think about the Affordable Care Act and all these different changes over time, that classic characterization seems to be changing. And so I think that one of the things as the years go by here is we'll probably have to be more disaggregated in how we think about insurance. And oftentimes we're doing that to kind of think about socioeconomic status, et cetera. Some of these pieces may be less tied to socioeconomic status as time goes on due to new laws and regulations and changes, et cetera.
Yeah, it's a great point. Well, as someone who thinks a lot about quality of care, I would say the fact that they can't distinguish admissions for new onset versus existing diabetes is the biggest one for me. And it's not their fault, right? It's the limitation of the data. But if we're thinking about assessing quality of care and access to care for kids, ideally we'd want to look at the rate of DKA among people who already have known diabetes, because it's then in our power as clinicians and healthcare systems to keep them out of the hospital, keep them out of DKA. And those rates would be best indicators for the quality of care that we provide for these kids and young adults. Not being able to distinguish those, I think, is one limitation. And then using that denominator of all admissions makes the study kind of vulnerable to shifts in other admission types and rates, which makes it more difficult, as we saw, to interpret.
Thanks. So we'll start to wrap up here, and we'll end with the author's comments on their conclusions. So the first one that they make is what they've summarized before, is that pediatric DKA admissions are increasing with disparate rates in the subgroups that they've looked at. And then they end with an implication, is that barriers to care need to be identified to allow for appropriate interventions. And so we'll think about that here in a second. But first of all, I wanted to get to Joshua and Kasia's thought. We'll start with Joshua. Just your thought overall on the quality of this report. We've dug into some of the details and made nitty-gritty comments on that. But just overall, what would be your thought, Joshua, on the quality of this report?
I think the authors did a good job within the limitations that they have. I think in any manuscript, he's talked about the strengths and the limitations. And I think in Kasia's last comment there, she went through a couple of the bigger limitations, and Chase, you had mentioned some of them earlier. But I think within those limitations and taking those into context, I think they did a good job with the data analysis. Sometimes in manuscripts, we go extremely far with the conclusions, right? And we really extrapolate out. And I think that for the majority of their conclusions and discussion, they kept it within the data that they had.
I agree. This is a really important topic. I think that, look, we had a really great discussion about what these data mean. So they provided a lot of thoughtful information on DKA among kids. I think it's hard to really know the cause and effect here, but it's really fun to postulate.
Good. So where I want us to end, where we do with all of our episodes, is trying to wrestle with, should this change our clinical practice? Is this enough data to change what we do, or not yet? And then I think what's even more challenging, particularly with observational studies, well, how is this going to change it? The authors call for change here. They said, we really need to figure out what these barriers are, why things are getting worse and not better with DKA admissions. So Joshua, we'll again start with you here. Any way that you would see from this report, this investigation, how this might change the care that you provide, whether you think about that as an individual seeing a patient in clinic or more from a high-level perspective, from a population health perspective?
I'll go from the population health perspective because that's many days how I think. And when you put this data in the context of other data, it's kind of like when we think about the evidence base, it's not one manuscript, it's the meta-analyses, right, of all these manuscripts in an area. But I think that in general, what many manuscripts show is that there are some disparities that we see, and some of those may be racial ethnic disparities, some of those may be socioeconomic disparities, some of those may be geographic disparities. And I think for me, it's just always a continued sustained call to action. To your point, identify those barriers that may exist. And then to the second point, once we identify them, and really the critically and probably most important point, to address them. And so, you know, I'm thinking about programs that we have here where we're really screening for social needs and then getting people out to a community health worker to address those social needs and some of the kind of research and different programs that we've done here. In my mind, this kind of fits within that there may be groups that are disparate. Once again, it's always tough, one paper versus a group of papers, but there's some evidence here that there may be some differences. So trying to ensure that the work that we do really addresses that, if we want to move forward clinical care, particularly in this case, diabetes care at the population level.
So Kasia, let's end with you. You do a lot of thinking about this as far as getting this data, making it accessible to providers and patients, how to assess quality outcomes and how to move the needle on improving the quality there. So how might you take an investigation like this and advocate for change at some level in clinical practice?
Well, you have to take this together with, as Joshua said, sort of in the context of other studies and what we know. First, like, what would we expect in terms of DKA admissions among people with diagnosed diabetes? Well, as an endocrinologist in practice, seeing all the advances we have, all these new fancy technologies, the closed loop systems and CGMs, and, you know, we've really come a long way. You would think we would be doing much better. So even if we look at these data with a grain of salt and looking at among people with diagnosed diabetes, you know, adjusting for that denominator, we're not seeing great improvement. We're seeing kind of stagnant rates. And so I think it is a call to action. I think we do need to do better. And I think what we're seeing is that we do have these fancy technologies and these great insulins, but we're failing a large portion of the population with very basic things like access to insulin and, you know, affordable supplies. People are really struggling. And this paper is sort of at the population level, but we know of stories of young adults who can't access insulin, go into DKA, get admitted to the hospital so they can get a supply of insulin for their diabetes. So I think in that context, this paper is a call to action. We need to do better.
And with that, I would like to thank Joshua Joseph and Kasia Lipska for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I learned a lot, as I know you all did, and hope that you will all join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.